And we move to the final panel of the day before the reception. And we will be talking about a subject of considerable interest. It isn't that the others weren't. This is ethical issues in the representation of persons with disabilities. We have two people for this panel. Allison Lynch, who is staff attorney of Disability Rights New York, and Jonathan Martinez, who is senior director for law and policy of the Burton Blatt Institute. Allison Lynch is the staff attorney in the Disability Rights New York, which is a federally funded protection and advocacy system for New York State. She works in this organization with individuals with mental illness and represents clients in hospitals, jails, prisons, and the community in individual and systemic litigation throughout the state. Prior to joining Disability Rights New York, she was an attorney for Disability Rights New Jersey in Trenton. While a student at New York Law School, she worked as a research assistant to Professor Michael Perlin, a leading expert on mental disability and criminal law, and completed legal internships at New York Mental Hygiene Legal Service and the New Jersey Office of the Public Defender's Mental Health Unit. Jonathan Martinez is the Senior Director for Law and Policy for the Burton Blatt Institute of Syracuse University and a leader in the international efforts to ensure that people with disabilities have access to the supports they want and need to live full, independent, and inclusive lives. Mr. Martinez has over 20 years' experience representing people with disabilities to protect their legal and human rights, including precedent-setting cases, securing access to critical community-based services. And the Burton Blatt Institute has been a part of this disability law symposium for what, forever, Jonathan? I think from the very beginning of it. These two people will present topics on ethical issues in representing persons with disabilities. Which of you will begin?
I'm going to be starting.
And Allison indicates that she will do so. So welcome, Allison Lynch.
Hello, thank you for being here at the last session before the reception. I'm thrilled we have an audience to speak to. I know when I go to these, you know, CLE programs for attorneys, they always put the ethics session right before you're done for the day, so you can't like sneak out. You have to stay if you want the ethics credit. So I hope that's not the mentality here, but like, thanks anyway. That was the setup. I really appreciate it. As we've just heard, I won't go through my whole bio, but I work for Disability Rights New York. I'm in the Brooklyn office, so I work in the five boroughs primarily with clients with mental illness, and we do representation throughout the hospitals and jails and prisons in the area. We're a statewide organization, so as I spoke to earlier in the panel on arrests, we also deal with individuals in rural populations in different parts of New York State, so we kind of cover a little bit of everything. And as you also heard, when I was in law school, I did take an interest in mental disability law and find a path that led me to this job. So I luckily did have a little bit of experience when I started in New Jersey, but there was still a steep learning curve, and there are a lot of ethical issues that play into a new attorney learning the landscape of disability law. So I thought this would be kind of an interesting way to introduce the subject for most of you who, I assume, are not new attorneys anymore and don't really need me to be lecturing about ethics, but this would be for people who come into your organization, for people who ask you questions, for your legal interns, things to just keep in mind that a new attorney might be questioning and might not necessarily want to raise for whatever reason, you know, be it embarrassment or they skip that case in law school and they think they should know it, you know, any number of reasons why they might feel uncomfortable talking about certain ethical issues. I'm here to kind of give you the framework for what someone who's new to the field might be talking about. And I also will apologize in advance and say that this, you know, doesn't happen if I'm going to court, but I will have to get really close to my computer screen to read certain things. I'm legally blind, and I did not adequately investigate the system that we have for PowerPoint here, so the font is not like the normal size 42 that I would like to have during presentations like this. So if I get like really close to my computer, for those of you who can see, that's what's going on. Just a heads up for anyone interested. So what I was thinking of doing, just to kind of set the stage a little bit, I'm gonna give you the kind of, you know, crash course in legal ethics for those of you for whom it might have been a little while since your last professional responsibility class. I'm sure you're ecstatic. For those of you who have never taken this class, now here you go. Now you've, you know, learned a little bit about the model rules of professional responsibility. So I'm going to take you through the American Bar Association rules that I find to be particularly relevant for people who are practicing in this field, and give you a little bit of background on that, and hopefully add some interesting insights based on my experience in terms of what issues might come up ethically when you're a new attorney attempting to kind of navigate these rules and figure out how to best represent this population. So the first slide I have up here, just doing a little microphone adjustment, this is just a little bit of background on the rules of professional responsibility, basically just saying that the ABA, the American Bar Association, has come up with these rules to guide attorneys in their practice and provide a kind of framework for how an attorney should be acting. And they cover everything from how you interact with your clients to how you decline representation to how you work in big firms. So it kind of is a little bit of everything. Each state can also modify to some extent what it feels it wants to in terms of setting its own rules. This is all stuff that you learn in some semester of law school and then for the bar exam again, but you know, it's not like you're consulting this every day. So this is more of just kind of a framework for when you think about ethical representation and you think about how you work with a different population than you may have been used to during law school, because, you know, as we heard earlier, not every school has a disability law clinic. You might not have had exposure to ethical issues that come up in representation of persons with disabilities. So these might be new things that pop up kind of while you're on the job. So the next slide I have just goes over a little bit about the responsibilities of an attorney in that very kind of formal ABA language. And it talks a lot about how you represent a client zealously and how you're an advocate for that client. And this is kind of a theme throughout the rules, is what's really important in legal ethics is zealous representation of the client. And a lot of the time in representation of individuals with disabilities, especially I've noticed individuals with mental disabilities, sometimes that can be difficult for a new attorney to really grasp, because sometimes you have a client where you may feel they don't want you to advocate for something beneficial for them. You may have a client who says, I don't want to take medication. I don't care what the outcome is of that. I will not take it. I hate the side effects. I hate the way it makes me feel. I will not take it. And that is your position. And it does not matter if you have a very strong feeling that, you know, client X should be taking his medication. That's not your issue. That's not your place to say. That's not what you are advocating for. And so I know that sometimes new attorneys will struggle in saying, you know, look, I feel really strongly that this person would be so much better off, you know, language like that, like they'd be better off if they just did this, if they just listened to their doctor's advice. And there's a lot that goes in there, and a lot of that is somewhat of a paternalistic attitude that people take towards individuals with disabilities. So a big piece of being a new attorney in this field is working through some of those biases and those stereotypes that you might have that might lead you to question whether or not you're doing something ethically correct in terms of representation. And that's a big one, is understanding that your client, no matter what the disability is and no matter what they're saying having to do with their disability, they are the client, and for the most part, they are the ones who determine the scope of the litigation and what you're gonna say about them and what you're gonna say on behalf of them. This is still their show, and it doesn't matter, you know, disabled or not. So it's always a good idea to examine your own biases and stereotypes, and you know, I know as a group we often admit that we all have those, so I, you know, won't kind of call out what some of them might be, but I think we all have a sense of what our frameworks may have been before we started working in this field and what's changed for us. So I think that's a really important thing to speak with new attorneys about, whether they're interns or law students or just starting out as real lawyers. Keeping that in mind always, it's an important thing to have as you go through representing in this field. So now to get on to the fun stuff, the real rules. The first rule is 1.1, and it's about competence. And for anyone who's interested, I'm not going to go through and read the entire rule. I have it up on the PowerPoint. If you can't see it, I can't see it, that, you know, so that makes two of us. If you are interested in getting a copy of it, I am happy to send you all of the information you could possibly want on the model rules. But because of the limited time, I'm not going to go through and read them all. I'm going to kind of do a brief summary and then talk a little bit about some of the issues that might come up. So what Rule 1.1 deals with competence, that's a lot of what I just spoke to, is basically a competent attorney and what that means. And some of the things that are important in that rule, excuse me, I'm just going to look at my computer very closely for a minute. So competent representation is the phrase that you see echoed through this rule a lot. And one of the things that that means, and it's something that we heard on an earlier panel from Ella Callow, she said, look, just because I might have a certain background, that doesn't mean that I can speak to everybody who might have a similar background. And the same goes for me, and the same goes for any other attorney who is representing a group different than themselves. You know, I can speak very well to some, for an individual who also might happen to be legally blind and colorblind and very light sensitive, because that's what I know, that's what I see every day. But I can't speak to the experience of someone who's completely blind, or someone who's deaf, or someone who has depression. Those are things that, just because they're a disability, doesn't necessarily make me competent immediately to speak about. And so I think it's important that we teach people who are coming into this field that it's equally important for us as people with disabilities who are representing other people with disabilities to do just as much research and introspection as someone maybe without a disability who's coming into this field. You know, the issues that we're going to face in these representations are not necessarily going to be things that we're familiar with. And so as part of being a competent attorney and being able to represent a client, it's really important that we do the legwork and we set the groundwork and the foundation for what we understand about a person's experience. And a lot of that could come from doing outside research, but a lot of that is going to come from sitting there and listening to your client and listening to them tell you what their reality is. And I think a lot of the time in law school, you don't always get the advice of, you can become competent in representing a client with diagnosis X by sitting there and listening to them describe what it's like for them. Because a lot of the time we might not have time for that as attorneys, or we're not taught to make time for that. So I think when I interpret this rule and when I think about representing an individual where I'm not necessarily familiar with the background that they're presenting, one thing I want to do is not just read, you know, the medical journal articles about some diagnosis that I've never heard of. I want to talk to them and I want to have a conversation and ask the questions of, you know, what's really going on here and what's important to you, and what's it going to be like? What do you hope to get out of this? So I think that's an interesting framework for the idea of competence, and not one that's necessarily always brought up in the course of law schools. Excuse me. So I'm going to move right along to, this is Rule 1.4, and it's about communication with your client. And it essentially says, hey, talk to your client, which is, you know, a great reminder for all of us with really heavy caseloads. It's still important to communicate frequently. The reason that I put this up here is, you know, not just to remind everyone to talk to their clients, but because in some of these representations, clients might be hard to talk to. Clients might not be wanting to talk to you. I have made a number of phone calls where the client will immediately, upon hearing my voice, say, I have nothing to say to you, I don't want to talk to you anymore, and hang up on me. And I'm just trying to tell them, like, hey, you have a court date coming up, you should, you know, prepare for it. It's sometimes they are not going to want to have the kind of communications that you would want to have. But it's equally important, regardless of whether they have a disability or not, to make the effort to communicate as frequently as possible and as clearly as possible. One thing that this rule sets out is making sure that a client really understands what's happening throughout the scope of their representation, throughout the course of whatever is happening. And again, some clients it may be very difficult to sit down with somebody who, you know, is off medication and extremely manic and, you know, pacing around the room and responding to internal stimuli. There can be a lot going on. But that doesn't mean that you walk into a room, you see that happening, you say, yeah, no, I'm not going to get through to this guy, and you turn around and leave. That's not appropriate representation for the individual. And so I think this rule really reminds us of this fact, and it's a really good idea to kind of keep that in your mind as being prepared for any number of different receptions when you try and communicate with a client. It might not always be the very straightforward, easy email or phone conversations that you might be expecting. So the next rule is one that they spend about 4 weeks on in law school. It's 1.6. That's to do with confidentiality of information. I'm going to spend about 3 seconds on it because we all know the importance of it. You know, keep it confidential. I feel like I have to put this in here because that's the big one, but we all know that, regardless of disability, regardless of whatever other characteristics, you know, don't bring confidentiality. It doesn't matter if the client has a disability and someone says, oh, you know, tell me about this, you know, that still, none of their business. Keep it confidential. I'm going to move on. You guys know this stuff. So I have a second slide on confidentiality because, you know, I have to. But again, time permitting, I'm not going to do this right now. I'm going to go to one of the more interesting rules, which is 1.14, and it's titled Client with Diminished Capacity. And so this rule, if you will excuse me, I am going to just slide my mic out and do a little bit of a dramatic reading for you, because I do want to spend a little bit of time just going through what this rule says specifically, and I don't want to screw it up when I summarize it. So this rule says that when a client's capacity to make adequately considered decisions in connection with a representation is diminished, whether because of minority mental impairments or for some other reason, the lawyer shall, as far as reasonably possible, maintain a normal client-lawyer relationship with the client. That's really interesting. Maintain a normal client-lawyer relationship. Normal is like a really, really broad term, and leave it to lawyers to, you know, leave it that open-ended and kind of let you interpret that as you will. But I think it's really telling that the American Bar Association, in all of these rules that it's come out with, says specifically, when you represent populations that might have a disability, I'm reading this really broadly and saying, you know, diminished capacity in this sense, in my practice area, is some form of mental disability. When you're representing a client, you have to start with the assumption that you are going to have an entirely normal client-lawyer relationship. And I think that's really significant. And, you know, unfortunately, in some law school courses, I think this is kind of skipped over a little bit. But what I think new lawyers understand really quickly when they come into practice, especially if they start working for a public interest group or as a public defender or in any way in, you know, the system. I like the term the criminal legal system from what we heard earlier, and I'm going to kind of start to use that. Especially in systems like those, you're going to see a lot of clients who might fall under this rule of diminished capacity, whatever you want to classify as that. And I think it's a really important assumption that you always have to make when you go into meeting with a client, even if you've been told already, oh, this person's crazy. You hear that a lot if you follow someone else into a room after someone's, you know, just been arrested, or you've just going to a hospital to meet a client for the first time. You know, you might hear a staff person say, oh, yeah, no, that guy, you're never going to talk to him. Good luck. That one I've heard a lot. Is, you know, I'm here to see this guy. And the staff person looks at me, and I look in the room and go, okay, yeah, good luck. And that's not how you set a normal lawyer-client relationship. I mean, this is just, in very few other populations would you have someone so blatantly say, this guy is not worth treating like any other client. And, you know, I think it's really important to recognize that the American Bar Association has taken the time to specifically state that, no, that's not how we're going to view this, and we're going to put this into writing that attorneys need to focus on maintaining the normalcy of any kind of client-lawyer relationship, regardless of mental disability or, you know, as they call it, diminished capacity. So I'm going to do a quick little reading again here. So basically, I'm not going to take you through the rest of this rule because I want to leave enough time for Jonathan and for questions. But essentially, that's all I have on the big rules. You know, what I really wanted to emphasize today was just the importance of starting from a framework that says, I may have a client with a disability, however, that is not going to necessarily impact the way in which I represent that client. And to me, this is a no-brainer. After a few years doing this to you guys, I'm sure it's a no-brainer. But to new attorneys, this can be a really daunting prospect, especially if they've never heard that kind of sentiment before. So I think as simple as it may sound to all of us sitting here, it's a really important lesson that we internalize when we talk to new lawyers who are entering this field who may have absolutely no experience with this kind of representation before. You know, learning this stuff takes time, and I think it's really important to put ourselves in the position of someone who has never done this before and to remember what it was first like when we made a mistake or we used a term that we shouldn't have used. I mean, it happens to the best of us, and we just have to be as empathetic as possible to people who are coming in for the first time and kind of teach them the ropes. And I feel like these rules are a good place to start in terms of where you can have conversations about appropriate representation or when you disclose information or how you handle a client who has diminished capacity. There's a lot here, and there are a lot of good conversations that can be brought. So I'm going to turn it over to Jonathan, and then happy to answer any questions that you guys might have.
Jonathan Martinez from Burton Blatt Institute.
We're experiencing technical difficulties. Please stand by.
We used to have microphones. I'm told we're about to be over with this difficulty. How are we doing?
I think we're good.
Go for it.
Just lost my screen.
Yeah, I know. It's coming.
He's about to get the right answer, yes.
Awesome. Yeah. We're good.
All right, Jonathan.
Thank you so much. My name is Jonathan Martinez. I am the Senior Director for Law and Policy for the Burton Blatt Institute. I want to thank Allison for going through the rules. My presentation is going to focus specifically on the interplay between those rules and our practice, specifically applying what I would call the moral requirements of the ethical rules to our practice, not just our representation, but our practice, the remedies we seek, the work we do, what we do in negotiations. And confession, I say that knowing that I am speaking to a room full of literally the greatest legal minds in civil rights who have a really long list of great accomplishments. So obviously the one thing missing is someone like me telling you what to do. So with that in mind, I want you to think about some of the accomplishments you've had, some of the rights you've defended, some of the settlements you've achieved, the way you have expanded opportunity for people with disabilities, and answer a simple question. Which one's your favorite? What's your favorite right? Not just a thought exercise, by the way, but the number one icebreaker for the reception immediately following this presentation. But think for a moment. What's your favorite right? Is it free speech? Is it accessible elections, the right to access public accommodations? Is it community integration? Well, ask yourself this question when you're thinking about that. What do all of those rights have in common? Choice. The right to free speech, the right to say what you want, the right to community integration, the right to choose where to live, the right to supported employment, the right to choose your place to work. The right to make choices is what makes all of the other rights worthwhile. On your screen is a quote from Jean-Paul Sartre, who I know is not the sunshiniest of writers, but he gets it right. He says, "I am my choices. I cannot not choose. If I do not choose, that is still a choice. If faced with inevitable circumstances, we still choose how we are in those circumstances." Amen. Our choices define us. Good, bad, silly, significant, casual, critical. They say who we are, who we want to be. They teach us our mistakes just as much as our successes. The right to make choice, undoubtedly, the most important of the ones we have, in my opinion. So, clinically, we call that self-determination. Self-determination, as we know from decades of research, a fancy way of saying control over your life, being a causal agent, acting rather than being acted upon, doing rather than having things done to you. And we've known for four decades of research that when people with disabilities have more self-determination, they have better lives. Study after study has found that when people have greater control over their lives, they are healthier. They are more independent, they are more well-adjusted, they are better able to recognize and avoid abuse when they have more control over their lives and their situations. Now think for a moment about Rule 1.14, which says that our obligation as attorneys is to ensure that clients with, quote, diminished capacity, unquote, have an equal opportunity to engage in the representation. That if a person has diminished capacity, whatever that means, the lawyer has an ethical obligation to ensure that that person is able to participate in the representation, going so far as to say it is the lawyer's obligation to seek out assistance and support. To say that a person may want someone in the room with him or her to help that person understand his or her choices and make his or her choices. That right there is a call requiring lawyers ethically to ensure that your clients can exercise this exact self-determination. It is the key to good representation. After all, if your client is not an equal partner with you, you cannot have effective communication, you cannot ensure confidentiality, and you certainly cannot make an effective representation or even a settlement offer. So about those rights. Those ones that are so important, self-determination among them, are they worth anything if you're not allowed to exercise them? If you've gotten a great settlement that ensures someone access to community integration, and you say, good news, you can choose where to live. Bad news, you don't have the right to make that choice. Good news, you can get out of this sheltered workshop. Bad news, there's someone with the power to say, you can't. Good news, you can go where you want and see who you want. Bad news, there is someone who says that you won't be doing that. You'll only be going out when I say you can. Are they even right? Are you at that point even a citizen? Professor Dinnerstein calls people in that situation having suffered a civil death. people under guardianship specifically, because for 2,000 years, we've been doing exactly that to people with disabilities. Going back to the Roman Empire, if you were feeble-minded, their word, you were put under a curator who had the power to make decisions for you. In feudal Britain, if you were an idiot or a lunatic, and yes, they drew a distinction, you were put under a committee who was empowered to make decisions for you. And here in America, that is guardianship. Guardianship, a different thing in every state, but every state has the essential same requirement. If a judge decides that you cannot make decisions, that you are incapacitated, the judge will take your rights and give them to someone else. That other person becomes you, substantiating Professor Dinnerstein's comment, a civil death, because you cannot act, interact with society, except through the auspices of your guardian. And it's worse than you think, because the studies say that 90% of guardianships are plenary or full, where the guardian has the power to make all decisions for the person. Truly a civil death. Another thought exercise for the people in this room. I want y'all to think back for a second to 1995. Think back to what things were like for people with disabilities in 1995. I also say that knowing that there are people in this room who were probably in grade school in 1995. Allison, from the bottom of my heart and on behalf of everyone in this room, we hate you very much. Everyone else, think about what things were like for people with disabilities. 1995 was only 5 years after the ADA was passed. It was 4 years before the Olmstead decision, so it was still perfectly okay to warehouse people with disabilities in institutions. Sheltered workshops were not only an employment option, they were a preferred employment option in vocational rehabilitation. We did not have Medicaid waivers like we do now. Now think about 2016, 21 short years later. Community integration is a right. Supported employment is an expectation. Probably everyone in this room is carrying a computer in their pocket that is more powerful than anything that was on a desk in 1995. We have more ways to make more people more independent than ever before, yes? Then someone answer this question. Why have the number of people under guardianship tripled in the last 21 years? There are 1 million more people under guardianship today than there were in 1995. So those questions, were they so stupid? When you can fight for someone's rights, when you can achieve rights for an entire class of people, understand this. There are 1 million people just in the last 20 years who've been left behind because they're not allowed to exercise their rights. And we've known for the same amount of time that we've known that self-determination is a good thing, that the lack of self-determination is a bad thing. People who are under guardianship, under specifically overbroad or undue guardianship, are less healthy. They live less long. They have lower self-esteem. They have worse objective and subjective health. They are less well able to adjust to increasing care needs. So where do we go from here? If we take it as a given that rights are a good thing, and that self-determination is a good thing, if we take it as another given that losing rights or the inability to exercise rights is a bad thing, then we also must take it as a given that some people need additional assistance to exercise their rights. In fact, I think every person needs assistance to exercise their rights. If there's someone in this room who never gets help doing something, please raise your hand. I'd like to see you afterward. No, we all need help doing things. But it's a truism to think that some people do need additional support. Some people need supports and services like assistive technology. They need people to talk to. They need support in the way they live their everyday lives or balance their budgets or do their activities of daily living. So if we take those as givens, that some people will always need additional support as they age or due to their disability or just due to the fact that they're human, we need a third way. We need something that's not no support or full guardianship, and that way is supported decision-making. Lots of words up on your screen now, I know because I wrote them, and it goes like this. Supported decision-making is a recognized alternative to guardianship where people with disabilities use trusted friends, family members, and professionals to help them understand the situations and choices they face so they can make their own decisions without the need for a guardian. I hope everyone noted I was not looking at my screen at that time. And I feel bad for Professor Blank, who's not here today, who had to sign on as first author to that paper with all of those words there, because I messed up when I wrote all those words. What I should have just said was, what is supported decision making? Think about the way you make decisions. Think about what you do when you are faced with something that confuses you. When you go to the doctor and the doctor speaks jargon. When you go to the auto mechanic and the auto mechanic speaks jargon. What do? You say, English, please, or in my mother tongue, or explain it to me like I'm a five-year-old, or stop talking down to me and help me understand what it is I need to do. And when the doctor says, you have a crick in your neck rather than a subluxation in your cervical area, and you say, thank you, I get it, you have exercised supported decision-making. So what I should have said is that supported decision-making is just getting help when you need it, just like you and I do every single day. The difference is that when you ask for assistance, when you get a second opinion, when you ask for clarification, you're smart. You're judicious. You're wise. You're examining your options. Person with a disability does it, they're weak. They're stupid. They need to have their rights taken away because only people with disabilities are held to the Mr. Spock standard. You are either 100% completely logical and 100% able to do everything yourself, or you are unable to do anything. Why do we do that? Why do we create that kind of dichotomy when it is a truism as much as anything else that all of us engage in supported decision-making every day? And doesn't supported decision-making sound just like Rule 1.14? Rule 1.14, the comments to it make it really clear that the normal attorney-client relationship is based on the assumption that the client, when properly advised and assisted, is capable of making decisions. When properly advised and assisted, we have an obligation to properly advise and assist the people we work with. We engage in supported decision-making with and for our clients. And the purpose of my presentation is to say that this ethical obligation carries beyond the discrete attorney-client relationship. If we take it as a truism, as the research says, that when people have more control over their lives, they have better lives. If we do what researchers like Professor Waymire from Kansas say, and say that self-determination is a best practice across the professional spectrum, then I think we have more than an ethical obligation to ensure this type of support when we speak with our clients. I think we have an obligation to ensure that this type of support is available when we speak for our clients, when we seek remedies for our clients, when we advocate for our clients, because supported decision-making can bridge all of the gaps that have separated people with disabilities, people specifically with disabilities in decision-making or perceived cognitive disabilities, separated them from everyone else. You know, someone says, I need help, explain that to me. Person doesn't have a cognitive disability, they're being smart. Person does have a cognitive disability, they obviously can't make decisions. Well, supported decision-making can do for them what you do with it every day. It can help you weigh your options. You might just need a friendly ear. Hey, can you explain this to me? I'm not sure I'm getting it. You can have a formal relationship like powers of attorney. You can ensure that decisions are based upon your preferences and your opinions. You can help communicate. Has anyone in this room ever said to someone, hey, please explain it to that person. They're not getting it when I say. You've engaged in supported decision-making in your communication of your decisions. So when people say about people who are, quote, nonverbal, unquote, that they are necessarily incapacitated, think again. There are many ways of communication, and through the use of appropriate supports, we can ensure that people who use every means of communication have the same right to make the same choices as everyone else, because if we accept that self-determination is a good thing, then supported decision-making increases self-determination. Think about it. It's obvious. If you are the final decision-maker in your life as opposed to someone else, you by definition have a greater degree of control over your life and therefore have an access to the study-supported, research-related benefits of supported decision-making, including greater community integration, including greater employment, greater financial independence. If these are appropriate goals for our clients, then we must include them in the work we do. And opportunities to do that are all around us. Here are just a few. Any special education lawyers in the room? Great. Special ed. You know what schools never do? They never read the purpose of the IDEA. They all say FAPE. and just we have to get educational benefits, right? Congress actually told us what the schools are supposed to do. It's in the bold bottom of your screen. The purpose of special education is to, quote, prepare students for further education, employment, and independent living. It is the school's job, K through 22, to ensure that students have what they need to live independent lives. Yet, studies have shown that the number one referral for guardianship, the number one source for people losing their rights, are schools. I've been around the country in the last 2 years talking about supported decision making, and every state I go to, multiple parents tell me, my school sent me a letter saying, when your child turns 18, you better get guardianship. If you don't get guardianship, you won't have a say in your student's life. Multiple parents have said, teachers have come to me saying, you've got to get guardianship or you won't be able to have a say. So schools, with an obligation, I say again, to ensure independent living, are the number one source of dependency. Why? Especially when transition services, for my money, the most important part of special education, specifically requires schools to provide coordinated services that ensure that students have access to, quote, post-school adult living objectives and, when appropriate, acquisition of daily living skills. Transition begins no later than age 16, several states age 14. So whenever I hear of a school telling a parent, you better get guardianship at 18, the first question I have for the school is, what the hell have you been doing for 2 years? You haven't done your job. In fact, I would say, starting from age 3, starting from the very first IEP, you should be asking, where are the self-determination goals in the student's IEP? Your job, school, is to ensure independent living. What are your policies about developing self-determination goals? If we develop self-determination, if we develop decision-making supports at a young age, then independent decision-making is an expectation and a habit, and guardianship doesn't come into the equation, does it? One of the greatest accomplishments of my former office, who I'm still a partner with, is at the D.C. Public Schools. Until a few years ago, D.C. Public Schools had a written policy requiring teachers to refer parents to guardianship at 18, literally in writing. And thanks to the work of the now legal director of Quality Trust, Morgan Whitlatch, they changed that and they got with the program. Their policy now and their curriculum now begins teaching supported decision making and self-determination in pre-K. I know it sounds funny getting support to make the decision between milk and juice, but again, think about it. If you're 3 and you know you have the right to make that choice, and the right to get support in that choice, then as you get older and the decisions get more complicated, you have more practice in making decision-making. You have an expectation in decision-making. And if we do best practices, the student-led IEP, we have a laboratory of supported decision-making. Student at the head of the table, parents, advocates, teachers around, all working together to make the best possible IEP with the student leading the meeting. What does that sound like? Sounds like supported decision making. Sounds like Rule 1.14. So to special education attorneys, I ask you, I charge you, to the extent that I have that authority, and you feel free to quote me, I have charged you. When you are in your mediations, when you are in your IEP meetings, when you are in your settlement negotiations, when you are at due process, ask that question of the school and demand that remedy of the school. Where are the self-determination goals? And God help the school that says, get guardianship at 18, that has not warned a parent at age 16 that that child has decision-making deficits. Because I think that student is owed 2 years of compensatory education. And we see it also in vocational rehabilitation. The VR program, which in my opinion has more power to do more good than any other, and whenever I do that, people roll in their eyes, and I say, don't roll your eyes, know your rights, because VR has the ability to provide anything, literally anything, a person needs to get a job, prepare to get a job, keep a job, advance in a job, or regain a job. Well, what if the exact same things keeping you from working are the ones keeping you from living independently? What if you lack employment-related skills in self-care and self-determination, in interpersonal skills, or keeping up with your own hygiene? At which point VR always says to me, those aren't employment-related skills. Those are independent living skills, and we don't have to fund those. To which point I cross them with, would you hire someone who yells at his coworkers? Would you hire someone who isn't able to take care of him or herself and is a huge drag on your insurance claims? Would you hire someone who's disorganized, who can't get to work on time? Of course not. Those are employment skills. And at the same time, they are the kind of skills that we need to build independent lives. And think about the things that VR can cover. The code section, the Reg Act, and I'm a reg head, so please forgive my geekiness, but if you go to 34 CFR 361.48, you will see a list of mandatory VR services. It goes from A through S. Very specific services like assessment and counseling, medical and mental health care, transportation, service to family members, education. Oh, and I was wrong. It's not A through S. It's actually A through T, because T is anything else a person might need to work. So VR attorneys, ask yourself this. Isn't self-determination built into the VR system? Isn't building a person's decision-making skills already part of the system, and shouldn't it be? Because code section after code section, reg after reg, requires VR to ensure informed choice. Informed choice is, by definition, the counselor in VR working with the person, informing the person, making the person an equal partner, so that person is able to identify and choose his or her preferred employment goal and the supports and services needed to get there. I repeat, the person chooses, using the input from VR, his or her goal. What does that sound like? Sounds like supported decision making. Sounds like Rule 1.14. So I charge you, VR attorneys, and that's also part of your transition progress in special ed. Ask VR, what are you doing to make sure this person is self-determined enough to get a job and keep a job? What assessments have you done to examine this person's self-determination? And we have Medicaid. Medicaid introduced us to the wonderful phrase person-centered planning. There's a Medicaid requirement on it. Final rules say that person-centered planning, that services under Medicaid must be driven by the person, include people in the planning process chosen by the person, and occur at places and times and cover subjects desired by the person. I cut and pasted this slide directly from Medicaid.gov, and it says, person-centered planning must address health and long-term services and supports in a person-centered way with individually identified goals and preferences. Put those two together. What does it sound like? Sounds like supported decision-making. It sounds like Rule 1.14. Olmstead attorneys, who here has run into what we call the step two problem for Olmstead? Yes, the person has been found ready for discharge. Yes, there are places available in the community. But how do we tell step two? The person wants to be discharged, or the person does not object to discharge, especially when there's a guardian who does object. So we see Olmstead settlement agreement after Olmstead settlement agreement that has to go through multiple steps around that step two about trying to determine the person's desire and the guardian supposed to be working with the person. We could resolve that entire issue if there was a requirement in Olmstead settlement agreements requiring the use of supported decision-making and person-centered planning in the selection of whether or not to be discharged, and a guardian who does not adhere to that or who overrules the person's informed choice to be discharged is not an appropriate guardian. Just about every state guardianship law actually already says that. They say it is the guardian's obligation to maximize a person's self-determination. It is the guardian's job to make sure the person is involved in decision-making as much as possible. So why are we not challenging that? When a guardian says, no, you may have the right to live in the community, but you are going to, quote, stay in the only home you've ever known, unquote. Why are we not challenging that and saying, you've not done your job? You have prevented someone from exercising the rights that too many people have already fought for. Think about your effective communications cases in hospitals. There's been so many recently of everything about, VRI to sign language interpreters to language interpreters. And think about what doctors do. What doctors do when they're faced with a person who they think may or may not be able to make decisions. They say, where's the guardian? Or they talk past the person. So when we are arguing for effective communication, should we not also be arguing for effective communication around decision making? Hospital, what is your policy around ensuring supported decision making for patients? Oh, we can't have a third person in the room when there's decision making being made. That violates confidentiality. Oh, we can't engage in support because we have to make sure the person has capacity to make those decisions. Whenever doctors give me that, the confidentiality argument, I always say, you know, every time I go to a doctor, I have to sign a HIPAA release. And that HIPAA release says who the doctor can release my confidential medical information to. I can give permission for a person to give my records to my wife, my mother, my brother, my kids, and say, you are absolved from confidentiality requirements in the release of my records to that person, yes? So what if we were just to interlineate in every standard HIPAA agreement, caret, and also for the purposes of decision-making? Haven't we not just created a supported decision-making, a legally binding supported decision-making document that doctors and hospitals must adhere to? So when we are arguing for effective communication, it's not enough just to have the access to language. We must have the access to choice. The right to communicate is worth nothing if we also don't have the right to choose what to communicate and what to do with the communication I have. And with that, I'm just going to say one thing only. Again, I am so very cognizant that I am in a room full of people who change the world every day, who have gotten some of the most far-ranging rights, protections, and expansions. And I'm humbled to be here. I ask you, I do not charge, I ask you to consider your client's right to make choices. The incredible class action relief that you have gotten is unavailable to people who do not have the right to exercise it. So if we take the precepts of Rule 1.14 into our practice, if we demand that others do what we must do, if we give them access to the research-supported benefits of self-determination, then we will arrive at the interplay between ethics, morals, and rights. And when we do that, that's when we're going to change the world again and again. And I'll be honored to do it with you. Thank you so much.
There you go, Will. An observation or two, and then we'll see about questions. One is, there is one thing the rehab can't buy for you. Only one, but there is one. So you who read the regs over there, you know what it is.
What's that, sir?
It's real estate. But everything else, it can. Now, it has to want to, and you have to figure out how to make it want to, which is no small task from time to time. But it can get you anything else, but it can't buy you real estate. Now, it can help you rent it, but it can't buy it for you. But that's the only thing. The thing is wide open if you can just figure out how to get the bureaucrats to want it to be. Some of them do, most of them don't. Other observations.
I have a standard strategy when it comes to VR. You're going to hear no a lot. We can't, we won't, we can't do that. My usual response on that is, can you please tell me which regulation says that you can't do that? Generally what happens is they scuttle into a back room, you hear furious whispering and flipping of pages, and they come out and say, we still don't think we have to do it, but we'll do it for this one time.
Yes, I've had some of those experiences. I ran a few rehab people off from time to time. They were going to come listen to my impassioned speeches at certain places, and they got tired of me after a while and left, and I thought, well, that's an advantage. So, but we win now and then. Secondly, the case belongs to the client, not the lawyer. It's client's case 100% of the time. The lawyer can do what the lawyer does, but it never has to do with what the lawyer's case is. You might think this is my case, and the judge might think this is my case. Ultimately, it's the client's case. It never changes. And the lawyer's obligation is to understand that the client gets to decide. If you're not prepared to do that, represent somebody else who gets to decide. It's always the client's case. And it's the obligation of the lawyer to believe in the client. That has to do a lot with that competency we heard about earlier. You have to learn enough about the client to believe that the client has something to represent. And that you are in an honored position to do it. Those are my comments. I wonder if there are questions.
Yes, Dr. Maurer, Matthew Dietz.
Matthew?
I'd like to reiterate what you said, and the problem, the hardest thing that you do have, especially in an Olmstead case, is the guardian. And as a lawyer, no matter how much you want the child to go home or how much you want something to happen, I don't know what, as a lawyer, I can do to override a client's choice for a nonverbal child or another person who's their guardian. And in Olmstead, when you're thinking about choice, and you know in your heart as a lawyer that there are many ways for them to get equivalent services at home, that's the hardest part for any lawyer, any disability lawyer, to say, my client is the guardian. How do you say, no, my client isn't the guardian, but my client is the person with a disability? How do you change that? And how do you deal with that ethical issue that a lawyer would have in representing the guardian rather than the person with the disability?
Which of you would like to tackle it?
Both, but I'm not Allison.
Okay, Allison begins.
All right, great. So that's the first easy question. Thanks for starting us off on that note. No, it's really important. This is one of the most difficult things in this area, is when you're faced with a client who says, yeah, I am so ready to be out of here, and the guardian says, you are so not leaving. And there's such a tension there at all times. And, you know, the only thing that we can do as advocates is to advocate. We can be as zealous as possible in trying to connect with the guardian about why this is critical. Not the fact that it can happen, not legally, not we won an Olmstead case. Yay. Now, you know, this is our prerogative. This is what we can do with it now. But why is it important to us? We fought for this case, why? We fought for this individual client, why? Here, guardian, are the reasons that this is so impactful and this could make such a difference in this individual's life. You, guardian, you know, not to put too much of a guilt trip on you, you want what's best for this person, don't you? Let's talk about what's best for this person. That very well might be doing what you don't want to do for them. And giving them that recognition through the voice of someone that they might listen to. Here's what's unfortunate and you know, realistic in many ways. The guardian might not listen to the client in the same way that the guardian's going to listen to you as an attorney. And because of that power that we could potentially yield, we have to make it our obligation and responsibility to do as much advocating in the time that we have as possible. There's no way for us to override the guardian. You know, there's never going to be a time where we can say, well, Judge, the guardian doesn't really agree with this, but we're just going to go ahead and do it anyway. We, you know, unfortunately, we have to start with the foundation that that's just not the way that our system works at this time. So what we can do is, in the nicest way possible, pressure the hell out of them and make them understand why this is so critical and make them understand from the client's perspective why this would be such an impactful move for them, to give an example of an Olmstead case. But, you know, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, And as we heard, it takes a lot of believing in the client's position. Not just being an advocate because that's your job, but believing that this is what's best for the client. And I think everyone in this room here would not be doing this work if they didn't believe in a lot of these positions. So I think coming at it from that place where we all know this is really a good thing, we can work as hard as possible to make guardians see that as well.
Jonathan?
Everything Allison just said plus this. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. The fact of the matter is that when you have a guardian who has the legal right to make a decision, we cannot override that without busting the guardianship. Now, with that said, something else everyone here already knows. The sign says attorney and counselor at law. We have the ability to counsel and to advocate. And one way that I recommend doing it in this situation is spelled out in Rule 1.14 in the comments to it. Rule 1.14 comments talk about creating networks, bringing in people to help make the decision, to understand the situation and choices at hand. And I've always been of the opinion that decision making is not a discrete thing. It is not black or white. It is not one moment. It actually is the sum total of our experiences and our input. And that's where we as attorneys can have the most effect, by creating a network, by using connections people have and creating other connections. Allison's correct. You're basically advocating the hell out of this and hoping to change someone's mind. But you know what? One person often can't change another's mind just by him or herself. But there are other people who are trusted. There are other people who can be brought in, who can be spoken to. There are case managers who can be involved in a case. There are other support systems and family members who can be involved in a case. And you can work on them. And you can say, this is a decision that is so monumental, it should be discussed. And it should be discussed by a number of people, a network. And I think that's our best opportunity. That's the way I have changed people's minds. It's not just me, the lawyer, pressuring you, but it's me and sister and counselor and case manager all saying not just thou shalt do this, but here's why. And here's why from my perspective, from my unique perspective, that's not just the lawyer's. And in that way, we have the best opportunity to persuade. But at the end of the day, Matt, you're 100% correct. We don't have the law right now to say, guardian, you'll do what I say, unless we have the wherewithal to fight the guardian. And some state laws give us that opportunity. And I have flat out asked people if they want to fight their guardian. Most important case I ever had was exactly that in nature. Do you actually still want this guardian making decisions for you? No, I want to make my own decision. And from that, supported decision making was not created, but I think ennobled.
Yeah, and one of the things that can happen is that it might be possible to let the guardian know that if the guardian doesn't lighten up some, there might be such a challenge, and that's always part of the bargaining. I want to mention a thing. We're going to get to an employment panel tomorrow, and I'm going to be on that panel, and I'm going to talk about a Sheldon Workshop case we've had. And I hope that it's as important a Sheldon Workshop case as I think it is. I have invited two of the people who are clients in that case to come, and they have now just joined us in the room. They will be at the reception tonight. So these two are Mark Felton and Joe Majors, and I would like you to take the opportunity to meet them tonight. It is an honor to have them participate in the law symposium, and you'll hear from them tomorrow. Are there other questions for these panel members?
Yes. Larry Berger.
Larry Berger.
Two comments. First, you did a great job of finding all the good stuff in the comments to 1.14. But there is still the black letter part of 1.14 about one of the things a lawyer can do is decide that the client needs a guardian. And I think, and I've confronted this myself on one occasion, that the lawyer who is representing the party can't be the person representing the person who's petitioning to be the guardian, but I must say the rule isn't particularly clear. That rule isn't particularly clear about that. So I think 1.14, it has the good stuff, but it also has the other stuff in it, and that is something that may come up in a particular case. And then my second comment is about Olmstead. And first of all, there's not only step two, but there's step three, which is when the person has gotten out of the institution and is now living in some other setting like a group home, which I don't know the statistics, but I think in my state, at least in New Jersey, that that's where most people who come out of the developmental centers wind up. And that both in the developmental centers and in the group home, they are very vulnerable to manipulation by the direct support staff in those institutions. That if it serves the interest of the provider to have the person remain more dependent than he needs to be, and yet the direct care person who's taking care of him every day has him convinced of that, that makes a very difficult situation.
Thanks, Larry. Couple of observations. One, you're correct about Rule 1.14. It does have good and bad. I think one of the ways we can address that is by everyone in this room emphasizing the good. Anybody here old like me and remember Pert shampoo? Anyone? Anyone remember the tagline? I'll tell two friends and they'll tell two friends, etc. If something we have talked about today has hit a nerve, if something I have said today about self-determination, about supported decision-making has hit a nerve, then tell a couple of lawyers. Because then maybe the lawyers will focus on the good parts of 1.14. Maybe we'll focus on that ethical and moral obligation. Second, with regard to manipulation, you know what? You're right. I get that question all the time when I present. You know, what about, how can you guarantee this person will not be unduly influenced? How can you guarantee this person will not be abused by a supporter? The answer is simple. I don't and I won't. I guarantee you right now there is a person who does not have a guardian who is subject of undue influence or abuse by a supporter, by a trusted supporter. That is a certainty. I also guarantee you that a person who has a guardian is the victim of pretty horrific abuse right now. So here's the thing. There's a pretty famous study by Professor Kempke out of Long Island University who found that women with intellectual disabilities who are disproportionately likely to be the subject of sexual and physical abuse, who had increased self-determination, who were given access to more control over their lives, were better able to recognize and avoid abuse. They were safer because they had more life control. So if I'm given the choice, and I'm quoting Samantha Crane when I say this, when I'm given the choice between a possibly unsafe option and a proven and definitively unsafe option, every day and twice on Sunday, I'm going to pick the one that's correlated with increased self-determination because that is correlated with increased safety. And by the way, we should never make the determiner of a person's right to make choices that person's ability to make good choices. If that was the determiner, if the determiner was, might we be encouraged or convinced to make bad choices, then I got to stop playing poker and you got to stop eating ice cream. That's not the way it works. The right to make choices is not subject to whether or not we will ultimately make a good or bad one. It is something that is inside and is a right given to us. It is one of those penumbral rights that is part of every one of the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
Hi.
And you are?
This is Rachel Langston. I'm a staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center in San Francisco. And you've answered kind of part of my question, but I guess focusing sort of on the communication aspect when there is someone who is either a guardian or a family member, I've had a couple of situations in which a parent has contacted me on behalf of an adult child with an intellectual disability, and I feel like in actually the couple of cases that I'm thinking about, that parent has really been a gatekeeper in an unhelpful way. Either, you know, they're the one who's contacting me, even when, you know, I'm talking to the actual individual, their child, I feel like they're just this kind of overbearing influence, and it's difficult because I know, you know, they're well-intentioned, they're trying to advocate for their child, and have been in that role for a long time. You know, I've had parents who advocated on my behalf, so I get that, but I think they're often in the position where not only is it difficult to ascertain what the actual client's choice is, because there is that heavy layer of influence, but it's also very difficult to advocate for them through and communicate that advocacy effectively to their parent, who may not agree with the legal, you know, conclusion that you've reached or with the strategy that, that you're suggesting. And that's been the two cases that I've dealt with where that's been the case, have been a real tug of war, and I felt like communication was really sort of hampered. So I wondered if you could speak to that a little bit. Thank you.
So that's a really important point, and definitely something that's come up in some of the cases that I've handled as well. And from my experience and perspective, and you know, that's kind of all I can speak to today, what has worked for me in the past is having two very different conversations, one with the client and one with the parent. And saying, you know, I'm coming from the same perspective. Look, my parents advocated for me. I, you know, got the special education that I needed. I got the, you know, large print when I was in first grade, and then was able to kind of expect that throughout, you know, grade school. Okay, great. I understand that parents do a great job advocating, but I also understand that they can go overboard. So with that knowledge, sitting down with the parent, you know, at the time that this is starting to be an issue, or, you know, if you think it's appropriate even before it becomes an issue. In some of these cases, if someone has a client and you know, you see that the parent is active in some way, having a conversation beforehand and saying, look, this is how I represent, this is my style, and what's really important to me is making sure that your son or daughter or family member is the person who's directing what I do. And I know how much time and effort you've put into helping them. It shows. It's very apparent, and you know, you've incredibly enriched their lives for it. However, right now, that can't be your role, because that's my role. I have to be the advocate now. And I have to advocate based on whatever it is my directive is, and that can only come from the client. And you know, doing this in kind of the nicest, friendliest way possible before it gets too tense or there's too much animosity can really diffuse some of these situations. Because if you've had the conversation, then later, if it seems like maybe there's a problem that's kind of arising, you can go back to the parent and say, look, you know, we talked about this thing where you aren't the one making the decisions in this case. And I just have to reiterate it because it feels like that might be happening a little bit. And you know, some of this is coming from my background in psych and, you know, motivational interviewing and kind of getting at the core of what the problem really is. And I think a lot of that stuff can be really beneficial when you have conversations with people about, you know, what are your goals as an advocate, mom or dad? All right, that's great. We're on the same page. But right now, I have to be the one doing the advocacy, and ultimately, it has to be based on what this person is saying, not you. And then having a conversation with the client, just to wrap it up really quickly, the most important party in all of this, having a conversation with the client and saying, hey, you know, I know it might be confusing sometimes, your parents might be telling you one thing, I might be telling you something else. You just tell me what you want, you know, and you don't have to talk to your parents about this, you don't have to answer any questions that you don't want to. You can blame it on me. Just say, you know, my lawyer said I shouldn't talk about this right now. I've done that for a client, and like, trust me, it is a 17-year-old's dream to be able to use that line on their parent. my special education kids are like, oh, that's so cool. Can I say that all the time? Like, no, only for the case. but you know, saying, look, I don't want to. It makes me feel uncomfortable to talk about what I talked about with my lawyer. You know, I really would rather not talk about it. And giving them that kind of permission. The parent might hate you, but you know what? The parent's not your client. I'm sure I have some. I know I have some parents who disliked that particular piece of advice that I've given. But I feel like it's really important is giving the client the ability to say, I don't have to tell you this. I have my own representation. This is my own case. I'll tell you what I want to tell you.
Jonathan?
Allison's 100% right in the specific. I want to address the general, because I think this is a perfect opportunity to discuss again why we need to incorporate decision-making and self-determination from as young an age as possible. What you're discussing and what Allison discusses is the result of a continuing expectation of paternalism that has faced people with disabilities for 2,000 years. If we start young and we build an expectation of decision-making and self-determination as a child ages, the parent will see and expect that. If we make that the norm, instead of the parent speaking for the child, the parent will speak with the child. And from that, self-determination is born. In the specific example, it's another opportunity for what I call the "it takes a network" approach. Bring other people in. Have a broader conversation if possible. I think the more voices that are talking, at least in the direction that you want them to talk, the better. But again, I say, create the expectation young, and we won't have to be having that type of argument when they're 17.